Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease and a whole lot of love, you transform 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. LED headlights, spoilers, whatever you need. eBay Motors has it at affordable prices. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride every time. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Welcome to the NASCAR NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan. Back here in person for the first time in more than a year and on location for the first time in more than a year here at the Daytona 500 winning team headquarters, Front Row Motorsports in Mooresville, North Carolina, and I am joined by Jerry Freeze. Jerry, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Nate. That's the first time I've heard our headquarters described that way, so that's kind of cool.
No way. Okay. that was kind of what I was curious about and where I wanted to start. And as I mentioned, this is Jerry's third time on the podcast, and the last two times, hugely well-received. You're always a great guest, so we appreciate you being a part of this again. The last time was 2 years ago, 2019. You guys had just moved in here from your shop in Statesville. So when I came in today, I see out front, there's the big Front Row Motorsports banner. But I don't know if I missed it coming in. I didn't see anything that says Daytona 500 champion or Daytona 500 winner. Are you guys playing that up yet?
Some stuff's in production. Let's put it that way.
Is the trophy downstairs or did I miss that?
No. The trophy's back. The car owner trophy's in Tennessee.
Okay.
And at Bob's headquarters. And Michael has one as well, so Michael's kind of had it on a road show of sorts. He took it to Phoenix last weekend and had some fun stuff going on in his hometown and showed it off. So we've had him bouncing around in here a little bit.
So I'm really the first person to describe this as the Daytona 500
first time I've heard it described that way.
Because it's been almost, gosh, what, 2 months and 4 days? Or no, not 2 months. Month and a few days since your Daytona 500 victory.
Yeah, still kind of sinking in, you know? I mean, it's I was talking to somebody, say, a week afterwards, and you do this a long time. You know the Daytona 500 is a big, big deal. I guess you don't really realize it till you're part of it. And then you're living everything post-Daytona 500, and it's starting to sink in that you won that race. And, yeah, it's just been an unbelievable experience. And you know, I think for Michael especially, and being kind of on the periphery watching everything Michael's had to do and continue to do to support some of the PR initiatives or whatnot after winning the race and stuff with our sponsors and whatnot. But it's had a huge impact on our company for sure. We've had some good performances since then, and we just want to try to keep it up.
Yeah, well, you're certainly off to a good start this season. I want to talk about all of that Daytona 500 afterglow as we sit here. By the way, we are socially distanced in the conference room that is in Jerry's office, which is the same conference room where we did the podcast 2 years ago, and you still have the exercise bike in the corner.
Yeah.
You have the big table here, and then, but I see here there's a new addition from the last time I was here. You've got like this 6-foot-high tabletop with a couple of laptop, or a laptop, and it looks like a,
a little bigger
tablet.
Screen. That's a standing desk.
Is that like your command center?
That is my command center. We've got a guy here, Mike Modell, who's done a fabulous job of resurrecting our landscape outside, especially the grass areas, and we are inundated with geese, so I can keep my eye on the geese on a daily basis as they try to attack our grass, and I'll send Modell a text to get out there, and he's got a horn and some other instruments that he wards them off with. So, you know, that's one of my duties here is to alert Moat when there's some geese in the area.
And it's equipped with like a tablet and a laptop, and I presume in the pandemic era, you're on a lot of Zooms. It looks like Zoom equipped.
Yeah, no, it's perfect. It's kind of funny. After Daytona, Bob was actually flying back after the race with the rain delay. He thought they weren't going to run, so he had his family with him, came on back home. And so he wasn't able to be a part of the post-race press conference. So they asked me if I could Zoom in on it, and I'm at home. I won't say I'm any Zoom expert by any stretch, but I was kind of in my den, and The lights were pretty low, and somebody sent me a video of it afterwards. I'm like, oh my God, I look like I'm in the dark here. You know, I gotta work on my Zoom presence here. But I got a much better setup here for doing stuff like that.
So I was listening to our last two conversations on the way up here, Jerry. And the last time, I think both the last two times, I checked to make sure your title was still a general manager.
Yeah.
Yep. So now you're a Daytona 500 winning general manager. Does that come with any sort of job title change? Still just general manager?
Yeah, you know, it's pretty simple. I'm not caught up in titles, and I've had just a great, great working relationship with Bob Jenkins now in my 13th year with him. And, you know, he's a couple times has referred to me as something more than that, but we've never really officially ever gone that way. I'm not even sure he knows what it is. But to me, I like general manager because I kind of feel it fits me a little bit. I don't feel like I'm a real expert at any part of our business, but I feel like I got a good understanding of every aspect of our business, and I can kind of keep my hand on the pulse of whether it's the car builds or the engineering side or the marketing side or PR side or whatever. So I don't have a real high, super narrow skill, but a good general application across the board.
I think we can all appreciate a man who doesn't get too caught up in titles. Yeah. Especially now that you can just like point to, you can just put it on your business card, Daytona 500.
That's right. That's
winning
right.
Team or car. So we can talk a little about that, Jerry. You mentioned it, how things are different since Michael McDowell's victory in the Daytona 500, winning the Great American Race, the third victory for Front Row Motorsports,
yes,
following the Talladega win for David Ragan in 2013 and Chris Buescher's win at Pocono in 2016. I don't want to diminish either of those wins, but that is not winning the Great American
Race.
Yeah,
it's not.
You know, what's changed the month plus since you've won that
race?
Yeah,
you know, I don't know that a whole lot's changed so much, but you're right. I mean, winning the Daytona 500 is just the biggest thing that, you know, I think any team can accomplish for sure. And, you know, when I think back to the other races, Talladega, it was just so unexpected as much by us as anybody else. And, you know, our program has come just light years from what we were in 2013 when David pulled that race off. And that one's still really special because of the way it happened with Reagan and Gilliland working together and making it happen. And knowing our cars were nowhere near what the guys we beat were. And so that one was pretty special. And obviously being the first one, Pocono was just flat out fluke luck. But this one, you know, I feel like we have very competitive cars in speedway races. Michael's really good at figuring out the draft and how to be in position there. It's funny, his track record at Daytona is, with us anyway, has been really good. In Talladega, we always seem to find the wreck, but probably not as unexpected that it happened at Daytona. It's still, he didn't go out there necessarily planning on winning, but we knew going into it we had a car capable of winning, and everybody executed, pit crew and crew chief, spotter, everybody did and brought it home. So as far as, you know, what's changed since then, you know, we've certainly had a little bit of good fortune with some sponsorship stuff that maybe was on the fence a bit when the season started, that we were able to close a couple deals pretty quickly and maybe getting our emails looked at a little bit more frequently than what they were before. And a lot of our inventory was pretty well already sold for Michael for this year. But it's helped across the board, whether it's trying to sell races on Anthony's car or with the truck with Todd. And, you know, so I'd say that's the thing that I think has had the biggest impact for us. Continuing to run well at the Daytona Road Course and at Homestead, especially Michael and the 34 crowd had a really great day. And I think it helps in the shop, too, when, you know, all those little details that you're asking the guys to put into the car, sometimes if you're just running 27th, the guy might shake his head and say, is this really going to matter where
wow,
we're running,
yeah,
you know? And so when it does start to show up in results, then it just has a snowball effect throughout the company that guy knows that, hey, if I just get a little bit more here, Michael and the team are capable of a top five or a top 10 or even winning the race. So I'm going to give everything I got. So, you know, it's had a good, again, just a good effect across the board that, you know, hopefully we can continue.
I mean, not to be too presumptuous, because there have certainly been a lot of different winners to start the season, but I feel fairly confident in believing that Michael McDowell is probably going to be in the 2021 playoffs. So if you're a crew member, you know, we're up here above the shop floor down there, like you're saying, like, if you know, hey, in race one, we're probably going to finish top 16 this year and not in the 20s.
Yeah.
That just changes, I would think, the spirit.
Yeah,
here.
It does. You know, we'd like to think we're going to be in the playoffs. Obviously, you know, we're kind of paying way more attention to who's winning the races now than ever. And we are planning on being in the playoffs for sure. And we'd love to somehow try to get through the first round of the playoffs. You know, when we made it with Chris a few years ago, and in front row wasn't anything close as strong as it is today. And we really had to rely a lot on Roush Fenway's support, who we do have a technical partnership with and have for years, to help maybe bring up front row a bit to try to be successful. But we were out of the first three cars out and not even close to making it to the second round. Here, you know, we feel like if we can get into the second round, we've got a speedway race at Talladega. We've got the Roval in the second round, and, you know, it's conceivable that we could make it to the third round if we made it through the first round. So we've talked a lot about, we got Darlington coming up. We've got a Richmond race that hopefully we can get a good notebook built up for the 34 car, so when we go back and race in the playoffs that, you know, we can be on our game, because it will be very important. With the next-gen cars coming, I don't know that we were necessarily planning on building new cars for the last 10 races of the year, but now we are. So we've kind of shifted our manufacturing plan and our prep to try to be as well prepared as we can for those first three races.
I know I saw, I think, a couple of announcements you mentioned. You know, we were just talking to your director of marketing, Jeff Dennison. Who are some of the specific companies that you've added since Daytona?
Yeah, so with the 34 car, Love's Travel Stop has been our anchor centerpiece sponsor of that program for a number of years. I think we're in our seventh year with them, and they basically have half the schedule on our car. I think actually 20 races this year. So they were back already for this year. Freight Auctions has been a great partner of ours for years that has generally done a race or two. Marcus Barella, that owns Freight Auctions, he's wanted to step up his program this year. This was before Daytona, actually. Marcus signed up for six races this year. CarParts.com was one that we had last year that we ran a few races with. They got their feet wet in the sport, totally digital company. Kind of a nice success story for us, because it was somebody that we got to sponsor us without having to sell any of the racetrack attributes that we normally sell really hard to a sponsor, because we didn't have them last year. So we were selling more of the digital aspect of what we can provide with that race car as the centerpiece of a digital platform. They saw some good results from that. Great relationship with Michael. Michael does a great job with creating content for them. So we were talking to him about expanding the program for 2021 here, and hadn't had the deal kind of all the way done before Daytona, and then after Daytona, they didn't want to miss the boat on another one, so they were quick to ring up Jeff, I think, the Monday after Daytona, and say, hey, we got to get this thing done, and we're going to figure it out. So and so that really was the last piece of the major puzzle for the 34 car for next year, is getting them on board. And I think they've got four or five races this year, and we still got a couple that are open that Jeff and the team have got a few proposals out that are pretty good to, I think, have some other folks sell it out here pretty quick. And even Freight Auctions, they're talking about wanting to add a race at one of the open markets we have. Car Parts is talking about adding a race to their program. So there has been a lot of enthusiasm around the 34 car, and we're really grateful for that.
The team just probably in the best financial position that it's been in a while, that knowing that all those holes are kind of filled?
Yeah, you know, Bob would probably argue that we're in a great financial position, but maybe not losing as much money as in the past. But yeah, I think we're probably in a better place revenue-wise than we've ever been, but we're also spending more to go race. And I think that's always been Bob's mantra. He's not in it. He's not in it to make a living, and, you know, I'm sure he'd love to break even someday. He's always been of the mindset he would like to see his contribution into Front Row Motorsports being into something we need to take the next step, not just to cover next week's payroll. And, you know, we haven't always gotten there with it, but sometimes we're a little ambitious with all of our plans of what we want to do, but probably in a better place revenue-wise than we've ever been.
Well, in some ways, Jerry, it seems like this is validation for what we talked about when I was here talking to you in 2018 and 2019, that, as you mentioned, 13 years with Bob, but it was really the last three or four that Bob said, hey, I want to get serious about competing and putting more money in.
Yeah.
And it seems like, hey, you're getting there.
Yeah, yeah. No, he, it kind of like a light switch went off. I can't remember what year it was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. It was right when we were going to do the alliance, full-blown alliance with Roush. Up to that point, we were buying used cars from Roush. We were like on the Tier 2 engine program with Doug and Roush Yates. We did win Talladega like that, but, you know, over the long haul of a season, you know, you're just a 30th place race car. And, you know, and he finally got to the point, it's just like, listen, if we're not going to do it, I don't want to just participate anymore. You know, I want to compete. I can't go throw $20 million at the team next year, but, you know, we've got to figure out a way to step it up to have the same engine program as those other guys, and that we've got a full allotment of tires, and that we're actually buying new chassis, not old chassis. And like I said, doing the alliance with Roush kind of shortcuts building that engineering staff. So we're basically paying them a fee to have access to their technology, and we'll buy chassis from them so that we're on the same product as they are at the racetrack, and we can share information and race as teammates at the racetrack. And our relationship with Roush Fenway is just, golly, it is by far the best it's ever been. Tommy Wheeler and Kevin Kidd are our two principal guys we deal with there, and they've really just looked at us as an extension of their race team, and so it's just come a heck of a long ways in the years that we've been dealing with them, and same too with the engine shop and with Doug Yates. And Doug probably always dreaded when he saw my phone call or Bob's phone call asking for a little help with an engine at Talladega or something, because we're paying, you know, a fraction of what
they're the B-tier team, yeah, as you said.
Yeah, so, but once, you know, we did step up and be on the same platform, the top platform that he offers, you know, I don't feel like he's never been a day I've ever thought there's anything that's being shortcut about our program, and sometimes we'll be at the racetrack, maybe back when we were practicing and whatnot, and if, let's just say that the 22 car had an engine problem, they needed a spare engine, well, the freshest backup was in our truck, and they came and got it. So we've got great relationships across the board with Ford and with Roush Fenway and Roush Yates too.
And even though the last time I talked to you here 2 years ago, you were a three-car team, then dropped down to two last season. Obviously, I'm sure that was difficult. And same for Roush at one point. They were five cars, and now they're back to two. But it sounds like, Jerry, like if I remember correctly, Ford was maybe pushing both you and Roush in this direction, that, hey, maybe we'd be better if you guys think of yourself as a de facto four-car Ford team. Is that, you just sort of said it there, that like Kevin Kidd and Roush Management sort of looks at is you guys as maybe as an extension. Is it fair to say that, like, that maybe we're overlooking that, Grant, you're not in the same building and you guys are here in Mooresville, they're over in Concord, but it's kind of like a four-car operation in some ways.
It is. I mean, they have a teams call every morning with the Roush staff, 7 o'clock in the morning, that our leaders here and their leaders there talk about, you know, what happened in the shop yesterday, or what was new in the wind tunnel, or what happened on the racetrack, or whatever it was. So it goes beyond the competition elements. It actually includes the production elements on a daily basis. So, yeah, we're not in the same physical building, but I know that whenever there's a new widget, let's say, that they feel like is going to give an advantage, they pick up the phone and call our technical director, Derek Finley, and let them know right away, Derek, we figured this thing out here, and you guys, we got two of them sitting here for you if you want to put them on your cars for this weekend, and we'll go get it. So in years past, you know, you might wonder if they had a few tricks that they weren't telling us about, but I don't think we feel that way anymore. And, you know, as far as two cars, three cars, and that's what I kind of alluded to when we've been ambitious in the past. I've been in racing a long time. I worked for Petty Enterprises for 12 years before here. And whenever you run three cars, there's always one car that's just not part of the group.
I've heard the same thing. Penske used to say the same thing. They were really hesitant until a few years ago when they had the Blaney car.
And I know Hendrick had that same philosophy, and that's how they start up with the two teams in the two shop in the two different shops. And I don't care who it is, you've always seemed like you've got two groups there in sync and one group out here doing their own thing. We've never been able to make it work. And for us, you know, we've had, when it's just two teams, they just got each other to rely on at that point. Right now, the groups we got probably get along better than anybody we've ever had, from Drew Blickensterfer on the 34 and Seth Barber on the 38. They've worked together at Roush, let's say 7, 8, 10 years ago, and known each other for a long time, and very similar in a lot of ways, and very different in a lot of ways too, but they're really synced up at the hip. And like I said, Derek's there with the engineering piece and probably got it lined up better than ever right now with those two teams.
Knowing that the last time we talked again, Ford was stepping up its support of you guys a little bit. And obviously, Roush Fenway Racing is a Ford staple, a mainstay for a very long time. Is Ford pleased by this direction that you guys are going?
Well, I'd like to think so. They were. We had a party for us about a week ago, or maybe 10 days ago, that celebrate Daytona. We had Edsel Ford on Zoom, and Mark Rushbrook was here, and some of the Ford team. So they were very pleased about Daytona for sure. I'm proud that we're able to put some points on the board for Ford. And sometimes you kind of feel like maybe we're there just to support the other guys. But now, you know, I don't know. I like to hope that maybe they look at us as you know, just as capable, maybe, or close, maybe what the other guys are, and capable of winning. And things are going to change with the next gen car for sure. And you know, with Ford, and I don't know what new could be coming down the pike, but hopefully we're kind of looked at as a semi-equal, let's say, with whatever their distribution of support would be for the future. And you know, otherwise all the other elements we have are really great in this environment with Doug and with Roush Fenway, and you know, we'd love to keep it going.
Certainly the next gen car next year is going to change a lot of things, and want to get into that discussion with you. But a couple more things from Daytona. You mentioned loves travel, and again, I was listening to our earlier conversation and I was struck by the fact that obviously Loves, I think, was the big sponsor that got the huge attention. Yeah. And you know, what could be better than winning on Valentine's Day?
Yeah.
the biggest NASCAR race of the year with
That's
Loves.
Right.
As your sponsor for Michael McDowell. The last time we talked to you, we talked about how there was a business-to-business element there because it's a fuel company, obviously service stations all across America. I know Bob Jenkins, the team owner here at Front Row Motorsports, has a trucking company, and there was some business that went on there that helped secure that sponsorship. And I think you said then that while Loves liked NASCAR a lot, that they weren't sure if they would have gotten in maybe without some of these other angles to it. And now Loves is the Daytona 500 winning team sponsor.
Yeah.
Any change in their perspective or seeing like how they kind of like, oh my gosh, we went from just being sponsor of the number 34 Ford to you know, we won the biggest race in NASCAR.
I'm sure, I don't know, I can't put words in their mouth for sure, but two things in particular. Where Loves initially sponsored us in 2013 was just two races, and Bob Jenkins' primary business is he owns a lot of fast food restaurant, Taco Bell's in particular. He acquired a trucking company, kind of not his primary business by any stretch, but you know, Bob's always looking for another business ploy, I guess, and acquired this trucking company, and they were buying Pilot Fuel, and the Loves rep was coming by wanting to acquire their business, and Bob said, you need to talk to my guys on the race team, you need to sponsor my race, Pilot's got a race car, you need to have a race car. And so they ended up doing two races, and I, you know, I don't think, you know, NASCAR was certainly not on their radar as an entity that they wanted to invest in, but anyhow, they did invite some high-end trucking partners to the track and had a great time. The one race they were on the car, on Gil Land's car, was when we ran 1-2 at Talladega. So
oh, wow. Okay.
It was good timing on that. And
that
and
was their first race?
It was their second race, actually.
Oh, wow. But, that's crazy.
But anyhow, they saw the impact on the customers at the track. And so they've used it as an entertainment aspect of taking care of their trucking partners that buy a lot of fuel at their stores and from all around the country. So, and the program's just grown from there. I don't know, and we haven't been a high-performing team that's garnered a lot of TV time, let's say, and been able to wow them with some TV metric numbers. And
until February 14th.
Yeah, we try to wow them, and they just poo-poo it a little bit and say, you know, hey, this whole deal is about the entertainment side. Well, like I mentioned before, you know, we were challenged last year with all of a sudden we couldn't have guests at the racetrack. We still can't have guests at the track. Well, that's the whole key to their program. And so we've tried to come up with some other things to add some value back and keep them happy. And so we've kind of had our ups and downs in the last year with, and I think they're very understanding that, you know, certainly this is nothing anybody planned on, and they've stuck with us through it, but it's certainly had its ups and downs with, you know, well, what are we going to do to make up for missing out on this experience that, you know, you guys were delivering, and to be able to deliver the Daytona 500 and all the TV value and the media numbers and the internet values and all that stuff that they pull together, you know, maybe they will give us a little more credit for that in the future and the potential of what it can be. And so that's certainly one aspect. The second one, which is more of a funny story, and I'll probably maybe get in trouble for saying it, but I just remember there is a Love family that it's a privately held company, and there is a family, the Loves, and so the patriarch is Tom Love, matriarch is Judy Love, and I'm not sure their exact age, but they're senior citizens, let's put it that way. And we had met them at a function early in our relationship. I was with David Gilliland, and we thought we were going out there and we're going to meet them, and they were excited to meet David Gilliland, you know, and we got there and it was clear they didn't know who David Gilliland was or what he did, and it was fine, you know, it wasn't any big deal. And we don't really see them a whole lot. They haven't come to too many races. We've had some other family members there. But anyways, I wasn't ever sure if we were really on their radar screen. Well, after the Daytona 500, Tom and Judy Love were hunkered down at a condo in Florida, and watching the race. And so Judy Love on Monday on social media has got her Michael McDowell t-shirt on, just as proud as she can be that Michael McDowell won the race. And Tom Love actually called Michael, got his phone number and called him and congratulated him on the win. And so to me, that was really cool that it was important to them. It had made an impact there. And clearly our little program has gotten on their radar since the early days. And so that part was pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. That's a funny story. So two races in 2013 and now...
Yeah, 20 this year.
20 this year. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that is a huge success story, Jerry. I wanted to ask you one more thing about Daytona. Like you said, it wasn't completely out of the blue. Michael McDowell runs well at Super Speedway mm-hmm. races. There was 2 years ago he was in
yeah,
the
2 years ago he finished fifth. Yeah.
Finished fifth and had a shot to win. He and Joey Logano had a disagreement about if one of them should have been winning or not. It's just kind of funny when you consider the finish of this year's race.
That's right.
But did it feel different this year in those closing laps? I mean, did it feel different than 2019 where it was like 2019 you finished fifth and maybe a move or two you can get to the front, but did it feel more like this year toward the end of the race like, wow, we could really, really win this race and have this be a complete game changer for Ferrara.
I mean, I can just tell you what was going through my head. And I'll tell you with Michael, too. Michael learned a lot from 2019. You know, he was behind Joey. This was the race that Denny and Kyle got a pretty good lead on everybody. Denny ends up winning. They're kind of making their way, making a charge on the last lap. And Michael kind of bails out on Joey. He's thinking he can get a run, and I don't know what he was thinking, but he ended up, you know, cost himself a spot or two and didn't help Joey at all. And I think Michael really learned a lot there. And when he was in the position this year, he knew at some point he knew his car was really good running with Brad Keselowski. And so when he got together with him, and it was, I don't know, maybe the stop before the last stop, and they were kind of back in 13th or 14th or something, but they were just talking about, hey, I'm just going to stick here with Brad because Brad's fast and I'm fast with them. We're going to find our way to the front, and he was not going to move. And so I think he learned he was win or die there with Brad Keselowski, and that was his plan. His plan was to push Brad to the lead and then hope to beat him back to the line coming off of turn four, and you know, it turned out be a little different story, but that was his plan. So I think he learned a lot from 2019 and really executed at the end. And I guess what I was thinking, when they were able, he and Brad were able to kind of bump draft their way past Kevin Harvick, which put him second and third, and now Michael's third, and you know kind of Logano's history with blocking, and you know, and Brad's going to be aggressive, and you know, it did roll through my mind as soon as Michael was third, it's like, oh man, he's in a good spot right here, you know, to either just beat these guys because they are not just going to settle to finish 1-2 and bring the captain home the trophy. You know, they're going to go try to win this race. And that's exactly how it worked out.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease and a whole lot of love, you transform 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. LED headlights, spoilers, whatever you need. eBay Motors has it at affordable prices. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride every time. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
So, as we said, again, I don't want to be presumptive, but making the playoffs would be a huge financial boon. I know when I talked to you 5 years ago after Buescher's win at Pocono, you knew then you were guaranteed pretty much top 16. I think at the time you said, or there was at least speculation, that a seven-figure difference?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, at least.
It is. Kind of with the way that we're paid through the charter system, it's a gift that keeps on giving to have a year of, let's say, overperforming, if you will, in the point standings. And maybe hopefully that can become more the norm. But the way that the as a charter team that you're paid, you're basically paid through three buckets. One is what you've earned on that race day. One is through a what's called a charter fixed fee. And then another one is through a historical performance, which is your last three years of performance. And there are some metrics to calculate that out versus the other charter teams. So when you have that one season that's maybe outperformed the other two, it's certainly going to inflate your car and where it ends up being in those standings. So we saw quite a bang with the 34 car in the years, the 3 years after Chris had won the race. You know, it goes beyond what you won that day at the racetrack. You're going to be in the point money. The year-end point money only pays through the top 25. So, you know, in that year, Chris was, I mean, we just barely squeaked into the chase by being 30th in the points. So we were not going to get any point money. We got 16th place point money, got the first place check at Pocono, and then the 3 years of historical revenue. So you start to add it all up, and it does become a seven-figure deal. So now this one, a little bit even better because it is the Daytona 500, which pays really a lot better than Pocono did. And
yeah, let's be clear. NASCAR does not publish purse figures anymore, but when they did, the Daytona 500 winner got $1 million+. So I don't think I'm speaking out of school here by saying Michael McDowell winning the Daytona 500 for you guys. The winner's check is well in excess of $1 million, maybe two. I don't know.
Yeah, it wasn't quite that, but because they've kind of balanced out the purses a bit. But it was good. Let's put it that way. It was really good.
And like you said, not just 21, but 22, 23, the next three seasons, this sets you guys up really well and essentially is a windfall of millions. It's not overselling it to
no,
say that.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. Is it going to make front row profitable? I don't know. But
that's Bob's question.
Yeah,
for you.
But it'll definitely help. And you know, we've saw it in the 3 years. If you just compare what the 34 versus what the 38 was making, it was quite a bit different. Even if performance was about the same, and it'll probably be even more skewed for the next 3 years, maybe. And you know, hopefully Anthony wins the race too, and we've got same situation there. But this system, if you perform, it can really help for sure.
Yeah. And you mentioned with Buescher in 2016, kind of explain it for people. You have to be in the top 30 in points if you have a victory and attempt to qualify for all those races to still qualify for the playoffs. And at the time, Buescher was kind of like on the edge, and there was speculation about, you know, can he stay in the top 30? Like you said, you kind of squeezed in and you made it. The same conversations started a little bit post-Daytona this year, but I think were quelled quickly when Michael McDowell then finishes sixth, I believe, at the Daytona road course.
I think eighth at the road course,
eighth
sixth,
at the road course.
Sixth at Homestead.
So. Sixth at Homestead, yeah, which first top 10 ever on a mile-and-a-half track for Front Row Motorsports. Mm-hmm. So
and ran there all day long. I mean, it wasn't a fluke. And me personally and Drew and I talked about it. I mean, it was the – to me, that was the best race Front Row's ever had. I mean, Daytona's Daytona, but you know, a mile and a half track, which has kind of been our Achilles heel over the years, to just be a team that's solid top 10 or at worst top 15, and great pit stops all day long, and Michael's driving his heart out, and it was just a really good solid day all the way around. So I was really, really impressed with how we performed there at Homestead for sure. So and optimistic that I do think our program's better than it's ever been. I feel like with kind of the rules, it is kind of almost like a next-gen car in some ways that, you know, we're not trying to revolutionize every aspect of the car right now. Some parts are frozen, mainly the chassis and suspension parts. So, you know, our stuff is, I feel like, as good as anybody's in that regard. You can still, you know, try to work on your bodies to make them as good as you can right now, and our team is working really well hand in hand with Roush on the aerodynamics. So I think we've got some really good pieces to take to the races coming up, and hopefully get back into the top 20s are just a routine finish for us, and more top 15s and top 10s.
And I don't want to diminish anything that you and the team and Michael McDowell was doing, Jerry, but there was a lot of discussion about that parts freeze after the first few races where there were some unusual top 10s or some unusual teams that were running. Not unusual, I shouldn't say that. I don't want to, like, again, diminish the hard work everybody's putting forth, but certainly you expect the powerhouse teams, the big budget teams, to always run at the front, and that hasn't always been the case this year. And the parts freeze is something that comes up a little bit. So I'm wondering if you can, you kind of just touched on it and explained it really well, but can you provide, I guess, listeners like with a perspective or an example of, like, where's an area of the car where you guys would have been really worried about, oh man, we can't buy what Hendrick or Penske or Gibbs have in previous years, that you're not worried about that this year?
It's in the suspension, to me, in the suspension of the car. The way the rules are now, you can't get a lot of skew in the cars, but you're still trying to get what you can. And so there's always a magic spindle or a magic trunk arm or magic rear end housing or something. You know, there always was anyway. We might get to the point, especially when you're running three cars like we were, that, all right, everybody's going to have the new rear end housing this week or the new spindle. And you finally got it. You know, you can't just spit them out overnight, you know, and they're really expensive too, you know. And so you suck it up, you buy those $5,000 spindles and your $2,500 rear end housings for every team, and we got them on the backup cars, and oh, there's a new spec coming out next week, you know. And it was like you just couldn't keep up. And it never really made a whole lot of sense either, that you never really were building your notebook, because you're constantly changing so much that if you ran at the track in the spring and you were pretty good, well, when you come back the next time, you know, well, the whole suspension has changed on the car because we just advanced it. And so those notes may not even be applicable. Well, now those notes are. To be on the same chassis spec for two solid years now and same suspension spec, that, you know, even though we're not having practice sessions, I just feel like when we roll off the truck, we're just more in the game than we've ever been before. So I think it does help the middle tier team such as ourselves and let's say RCR, I'll throw them in there, and even Roush. You know, you saw Buescher running really good at Homestead, I think it was. Ricky Stenhouse is running good, and you know, they're all teams I feel like similar to Front Row that are spending the money on engines and tires and got good pit crews and solid drivers and good spotters and crew chiefs and all that, and they're just not getting out technologied by the JGRs and Hendrick Motorsports of the world.
And those teams, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Jerry, because I always know just enough to be dangerous about race cars, but do they still have the advantage, like with body and aerodynamic stuff? When we talk about suspension, what you're talking about, the spindles, and these are like mechanical parts in the car that help it travel better on the racetrack or run faster. But the body aerodynamic stuff, is that something where the bigger teams still kind of have a little bit of an edge?
It's possible. There's even restrictions on that NASCAR's put in place with wind tunnel time.
Exactly.
Wind tunnel time and even CFD time. And so if everybody's abiding by the rules, they shouldn't have more wind tunnel time than Front Row Motorsports is allocated. So, you know, do they have more engineers working on it? Yeah, probably so. But I just think maybe when it was just, let's say, unlimited and they had time booked every week at Windshear or wherever, and we're going six times a year or something, you know, you're just never going to be able to bring the same mousetrap to the track. So the Hawkeye system has done a good job, I think, of policing the bodies to keep everything in tolerance. So those performance gains are so small. If they are advancing it, it's not huge. But you know, at the end of the day, it's all those little bits that, you know, they've probably got more investment into in the car or the body, and or even in pit crew training and things like that just keep them a little bit faster than us on the racetrack. But it's not by laps necessarily. It's more by tenths of a second.
Normally, I think when a typical race observer or media reporter, you know, somebody who's not immersed in it the way you are here, hears that, hey, the rules are going to stay the same. There's a tendency, I think, for us to think, well, that probably means that the teams at the top will remain where they are because they can just optimize what they have and they'll keep those edges. Did you know when this parts freeze was announced and that reduction of wind tunnel time, did you have a feeling that it was coming to you that it might result like this?
I'll be straight up honest with you. I had a good feeling that we were going to stop spending so much money on trying to keep up with the Joneses and really actually, let's say, mileage parts out instead of all right, this one's obsolete. We got this one now. And, you know, I probably look at it more from a dollars and cents than I should. But I'll be honest with you, I didn't really think that, you know, this would be our chance. You know, I didn't think eliminating practice and qualifying would help balance right. the field. I think it does. I truly think it does. And I never really gave it the thought that, you know, the resources, let's say at JGR or Kyle Busch's talent to take his car from here on Friday to there on Sunday morning was so great. And I didn't know that. And, you know, I'm just picking on him and his team for an example. You know, it seems like no practice, no qualifying has really hurt him. My fear was that, man, well, you know, you're there at the track sometimes, and you know that first practice you're killing the splitter or something, you know, and it's like, well, we're going to start the race like this. You know, how is that going to work? But our guys really went to work, spend more time in the shop, getting the car, I think, really dialed in for that race condition than they ever did before. And we've been pretty good off the truck and more times than not. And so I do feel like that's kind of played in our favor a little bit too.
And you compared the parts freeze with next gen, which we've talked about is coming next year. We actually talked about that the last time I was here a couple years ago. And it seems as if it's going in the direction we talked about then, which was, you know, more of a spec type thing, again, more standardized car. I guess a two-part question here, Jerry, like how much do you focus on next gen? How much do you need to focus on? When do you start focusing on it? And do you think it'll continue what we've seen in some parts of the Cup Series races this year where it does allow for more even competition in the field?
Yeah. When do we start focusing on it? Right now, I saw somewhere, I think we've got a track test somewhere in October, maybe, mm-hmm. with the first car. I think we can acquire our first chassis somewhere around June. You know, I'd like to think that, you know, we would definitely invest in a few chassis and the components to go on them and try to be ready to go when that first test comes around. It's one of those things, you know, I'm still not exactly sure that there will be a moratorium, how many chassis you're allowed to have and what that count exactly is going to be. I know there's a little politicking going on that it should be this number or that number.
Sounds like team owner council meetings are fun these days.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I got to believe that, you know, we've had some track tests with individual cars out there. Bubba Wallace was at Richmond yesterday. And, you know, you've heard some good and some negative on the car. And I guess I'm not in a big hurry to go spend, buy 14 transaxles at whatever they cost a piece. And just because that's the number we're allowed to have. And then they say, well, guess what? We've got a different iteration of this transaxle that's going to be better. And so I guess I've kind of looked at it. And honestly, we've put way more focus on racing this year than next year for the most part. I don't think any components are available at this point. You know, we're just kind of getting together with vendors and getting in their accounting systems, let's say, for ordering parts when that time does come. And, you know, I think it'll all start to ramp up, though, April, May, June. And we'll definitely, we're not going to wait till January next year to order our first car,
sure.
I'll tell you that. But we probably won't order everything we need in this summer either and kind of see how it goes.
Yeah, certainly as teams start getting cars, that'll change the game. But as you said, Jerry, I mean, even more so now post-Daytona, why worry about 2022 when 2021 presents such an opportunity
right.
for you guys? And do you think it might, again, this is me kind of spitballing a little bit and being the over-speculative media member, but when I look at teams such as Stuart Haas that have like struggled from the outset this year, some other teams like that, Ganassi might be another example, where at some point you would think like they're probably going to punt a little bit on 21 and start looking ahead for next year. And you're talking about like, hey, we might buy more cars this year than we anticipated. Does it give you an advantage maybe this year of any year to like, hey, we can be a little bit more focused on this year when other teams that might normally be will be looking toward 22?
Yeah, I don't know. It's not like the old days of NASCAR that you could go test all you want and you mm-hmm. know you're going to be limited with the amount of track testing you can do. You're limited on wind tunnel time. I think right now the rules are we can't even take a next gen car to a wind tunnel this year. Just the OEMs are allowed to. So you know, I don't know why a team would maybe shelve this year when there's so little you can really do outside of just going and buying all your chassis and all your components and bolting them together. And then what are you going to do with it? I don't know. I don't really see anybody shelving 21 just because it's not going quite the way they want. I think we all have sponsors we answer to, and drivers are very competitive, and crew chiefs are very competitive, and I would be surprised by that. But yeah, in our case, you know, I think we were certainly looking, and even with Roush and what they're doing with their chassis manufacturing. Roush, actually, they're not even in their chassis shop anymore. They reduced their chassis shop quite a bit and sold the space, and you know, so their capacity to spit out a lot of chassis is greatly diminished, because we didn't think either one of us were going to build a whole lot of chassis this year. So it certainly changed, and that's one thing we've talked to those guys about, you know, just, well, how many do you think you could produce here this summer, because they're just not as staffed up or have the, again, the capacity to manufacture like they once did.
So teams are already pretty well along then in that transition.
You know, like we haven't been on that side of it with manufacturing our own chassis, but I gotta imagine every team's the same way that does it, that builds their own chassis, probably looking at how to repurpose your chassis shop or reallocate those resources. So we're just buying chassis from them. We repair them here, but we've never manufactured the whole chassis.
The next gen costs, Jerry, this will be amortized obviously over several years, but I've heard that like kind of the one-time switchover was, most teams were estimating was like $3.5 to $4 million to switch your entire fleet over and to go from, like you said, building cars in the traditional way to that more spec type situation. Is that still a number that sounds like in the ballpark? Are you guys pretty far into that? Or I guess, like you said, it doesn't matter quite as much for you guys because you're different than the bigger teams.
Well, but I feel like the bigger teams are going to be like us because you're not manufacturing the chassis anymore. And, you know, you're not have the same body hanging process that you once did. You know, I think as far as what that number is, I think that's probably a good number. I think that's a number we're kind of working around for a two-car team. We don't have a real detailed grasp on, just because a car costs this much fully assembled, like we own 32 race cars here, but we've got enough parts to build 12. And so we just rotate those 12 sets of parts around the cars that we're racing. So, you know, it'll be the same way with the next gen car. If we're allowed to have 8 chassis, how many transaxles do I need to run those 8 cars? 4, 5, 3, I don't know. But, you know, they're going to have a mileage limit. We're not going to service them here. They'll go back to the vendor at some mileage limit, and you know, and I think we'll base our count on that. And you know, you probably need one spare at the track on the truck. You know, as far as what inventory you need and then how many sets of each component in rotation, that's what we've got to try to figure out.
Well, that's a lot to look forward to for 22. I'll wrap up here with sticking with 2021. So you've got, again, a car that's going to race, and Michael McDowell, you've got a really good road course racer. You've got a regular season that has 5 more road courses. You've got a road course in the playoffs. You know, through the rest of the season, there's a couple more super speedway races to come, Talladega, Daytona. Are you guys focusing on any of those races a little more? Like, do you look now at like a Circuit of the Americas for Michael McDowell and say, hey, that we could maybe make a little more hay here than we anticipated, it could have a bigger benefit?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, we went into this season, you know, looking at those road course races and really updated our road course fleet for this year with more races. And, you know, I think we've kind of treated road course cars similar to speedway cars, that you only run them a couple times a year, so you keep the same chassis way longer than you would a downforce chassis. And even with this year being the last year of the next gen car going into the next gen car, you know, with more road course races and more opportunities for Michael to have success, you know, we did invest in some new chassis and advance that a bit. And I feel like we've talked about Michael a lot here, and I'm pretty excited about Anthony Alfredo too. Whatever we've spent on the 34 car, believe me, we're spending the same on the 38 car to give them just as much chance. And so I look forward to Anthony going back to these tracks a second time as a cup driver, watching his progression during a race with no practice and no qualifying in a cup car for the first time, dealing with these crazy restarts all the time. That kid gets better and better and better every lap he's on the track. And had a bad one at Phoenix. We got in a wall early in the first stage and kind of killed our day. But otherwise, man, he has been really solid. And talking to the Childress guys last year before we hired him, that was what they said with the Xfinity car. You know, he would start the race. He might be the 25th place guy on lap time at the start of the race, but by the end of the race, he was just as fast as the leaders. And I won't say we're the same way with the cup car, but he makes a really good progression throughout the race, and had some good runs at Homestead and Vegas that were really encouraging, and tracks that he's raced at before. So I'm as excited to see how Anthony progresses in the second half of the year, because he's a really smart kid. He works super hard at it, and their team is working real hard. And, you know, and I think he'll be able to add stuff to the table to help Michael in the 34 team as well. And if Anthony's got a place, he's got a lot of learning to do. It's on the road courses. Going back to the 34, you know, like I said, we want to figure it out at Darlington and Richmond. Those are tracks we haven't been super great at over the years. And, you know, being the first two playoff races, you know, we just hopefully have something going our way for that one. So, you know, I think Drew will probably have a lot of adjustability in the car those races. And, you know, if it's not going our way at the start, we're not going to be afraid to throw the kitchen sink at it in the middle of the race and hopefully find something. So, you know, we'll look at those races more as testing for the playoff type races. And then, you know, like you said, go to COTA and some of these other places that we feel like Michael might be able to get that second win and really give it our all at those places.
I got one more for you that you just kind of triggered with talking about Alfredo. I'll give you a chance to just maybe end it by talking about the driver lineup. It's the second consecutive season you've had a rookie paired with the veteran McDowell. And for the longest time, front row is just kind of two journeymen veterans. And now you've kind of got this model of like young guy veteran. Have you stumbled into something that you think you like here, the way that the team's laid out?
You know, I don't know that we really purposely went into that direction. You know, I mean, John Hunter was really good for us last year. I think he really challenged Michael to get more speed out of himself. Maybe other guys in the past hadn't, you know, so we saw more out of Michael last year than I think we ever had, with just raw speed on the racetrack and maybe a willingness to try different things on the track. And I think John Hunter brought that to him. So I think he challenged him with just raw speed. Anthony, he is close to the same age as John Hunter, but Anthony certainly doesn't have nearly as much racing experience as John Hunter did. So we knew coming into this, there was going to be a learning curve with Anthony. But, you know, we felt like, especially after talking to some of the senior guys at RCR, that this kid's got a good upside to him, and he's got a great attitude and a great work ethic, and, you know, and he's been a lot of fun to have around here. And there was a veteran driver or two that we could have plugged in the car that would have been more kind of front rows, normal standard operating procedure. But I think we wanted to bet more on the long game, that, hey, maybe we could find something here. And, you know, it just didn't work out where Anthony could stay at RCR, and, you know, met him a few times and thought, you know, why not? Let's give it a whirl.
I'm sure that he is glad that you guys took a flyer on him, because he's now part of a Daytona 500 winning organization.
Yes, he
and
is.
So I will let you get back to work here, Jerry, with tending to the geese.
Yeah, that's right. Usually when, it's kind of cloudy today, but I've noticed I'm really watching their patterns. When the sun starts to go down, that's when they come up here to eat. So 4 o'clock is usually the time I got to be on my game. So.
All right. Well, you got some work to do then. We're coming up on mid-afternoon. But, of course, also work to do here on the overseeing the shop floor.
Yeah.
Again, terrific that you guys won the biggest race in NASCAR. I think you guys are a great story, the type of stories NASCAR needs more of. And always appreciate your candor and willingness to come on here on the NASCAR NBC podcast and discuss the challenges and what it's like being this team. So thanks again for being a guest. I really appreciate it.
100%. My pleasure, Nate. And do it anytime.
Our thanks again to Front Row Motorsports General Manager Jerry Fries for joining us for a window into the winning organization of the 2021 Daytona 500. As I mentioned, that's the third time Jerry has been a guest on the NASCAR NBC podcast now in the past 3 years, and it's always great to have him because he is willing to talk dollars and cents with a candor you don't always get from NASCAR team executives on the record. I think that helps a lot in helping tell these stories within the Cup Series, so many thanks as always to Jerry for making time and opening up his office to us again. And thanks as well to Front Row Motorsports Director of Marketing Jeff Dennison for helping set up the conversation. I'll be back next week with the return of the post-race podcast with a NASCAR and NBC analyst to be determined. Undoubtedly, that selection will happen with the help of NBC sports producers Aaron Feldstein and Emily Comboy. That's always appreciated in the coordination and recording of this podcast, so thanks as always to Aaron and Emily. The NASCAR and NBC podcast is available wherever you download podcasts. Please leave us a rating and review to help spread the word. And any feedback you can send to me on Twitter, at Nate Ryan is my handle. Thanks again for listening to the NASCAR on NBC podcast. Mm-hmm.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen, remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.